Welcome to the show, Pardis Cabrai, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're very happy that you could join us again today on our 2.5 hour special covering issues from torture to and the evisceration of the rule of law in the United States. Could you please remind our audience a little bit about our discussion we had a few weeks ago stemming from the Guantanamo program we did?
Sure, and thank you for having me back. We were talking before, around the time, or I think right before the 10th anniversary, unfortunate anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo, the day in 2002, January of 2002, when the first men were flown to the prison camp, and the fact that 171 people still remain, and despite President Obama's promises to close the prison, that it is very much alive and well and will remain open for the foreseeable future. So we were discussing the issues around Guantanamo and the continuing unjust detentions of the people still there and some of the challenges to closure that the administration has put up that we actually feel are not, you know, difficult. The problem of closure is actually a simple one, but that it's become a political issue and that's why it remains open. I've worked on Guantanamo at CCR since I've been here and since 2007 and have represented a number of men there, have gone down to the base, met with them. Some of them, thankfully, have been released. And as an extension of that work, challenging unjust detention policy by the United States in this context of terrorism, have from that started looking at other manifestations of abusive executive policy in this context, and specifically have been looking to the policy of targeted killing by the administration.
And the website, by the way, for listeners, is ccrjustice.org. And if you go to that site, the Center for Constitutional Rights, there is a fact sheet. Government kill lists target U.S. citizens far from any armed conflict. And we actually covered this at Project Censored in the Censored 2012 book when we talked about the executive branch claiming the right to assassinate American citizens abroad, I mean, complete evisceration of the rule of law again and due process. Could you talk a little bit about what are the government kill lists and why would you say this is illegal? I mean, it seems obvious, but you could explain that for us.
Sure. The basic policy we're talking about and our concerns within it are, you know, if we were all worried about a policy of global detention indefinitely without review of hundreds of people held at Guantanamo and elsewhere that the government said were all the worst of the worst, and that we know now after judicial review were not, in fact, terrorists or whose detentions were not founded, we're talking now about effectively a global assassination policy of killing people who are only suspected of being involved in terrorism, and sometimes not even, well, our concern is that many of them are actually not involved in any fighting. Even if it were lawful to kill individuals wherever they may be found who are engaged in terrorism, our concern in part is that many of them are actually not even involved in terrorism. We question the standard the government is using to determine who is and who is not targetable. But the policy we're now talking about, and this is a policy that existed under President Bush, but that has very much escalated and expanded under President Obama. And it is effectively killing individuals, wherever they may be found, who are unilaterally deemed to be dangerous to the United States, unilaterally deemed by the executive branch without any outside meaningful check on, you know, what criteria are being used, what evidence supports those targeting decisions. And these are targeting decisions and targeting practices that are happening outside of recognized war zones. So we're not talking about the use of drones or airstrikes against individuals fighting in Afghanistan or previously in Iraq. We're talking about people who are being killed far from those battlefields in places like Yemen, Somalia. There was a reported strike in the Philippines, reportedly that was assisted or led by the United States. There are many concerns we have about the policy. Our particular focus and the focus of the Alawaki case was targeted killings that are occurring outside of war zones, and questions and concerns that we have about what criteria are being used, where these targeting operations are being carried out. What was not at issue in the Alawaki case, but we're very much worried about, is the issue of civilian casualties that are resulting from these strikes. So there are many, many issues that we could talk about.
Pardis, this is Abby Martin. You know, you're talking about the unfounded claims behind the global assassination campaign and the indefinite detention. A recent poll that just came out from Washington Post, ABC News, talks about how 70% of respondents approve of Obama's decision to keep Gitmo open, and 83% approve of the U.S. drone policy that he's expanded. I was just wondering if you could speak to those and just the rebranding effort and the danger of the conditioning.
Mm-hmm. I guess I have to believe that those poll numbers are what they are because people still don't know. I have to hope that that's the reason why and that we're not authorizing or sanctioning the government to go after people who are innocent and should not be killed, despite what I think is very known, in fact, and where there's plenty of evidence to show, at least with respect to Guantanamo, that of the almost 800 people that were held there, most of them have been released by the Bush administration or the Obama administration, the government themselves. And then others, once there was an opportunity to have their detentions reviewed by courts have in most of their cases, a majority of those cases, found that their detentions were unjustified. But I have to hope that people still believe, as the Obama administration has either been perpetuating this myth of dangerous people still being held at Guantanamo or just failing to educate the public about the truth and the reality of who's still there, but that they believe that the 171 people still there must actually have been involved in fighting and need to be there, and that Guantanamo is necessary for the national security of the United States. But again, in fact, if you break down the number of the 171 people, only about 30 of them, according to the government itself, will ever actually be charged with anything. 89 of them have been cleared by the administration, by every government agency with a stake in the matter, has been cleared. So I have to believe that people don't know that, and we just have to continue educating.
This is a Kafka-esque black hole, to be sure, and you're really on to something. There's been just relentless and endless propaganda campaign under the Orwellian guise of the nebulous war on terror, and people really sort of throw their own projected beliefs and ideas, you know, sort of a motivated reasoning. Well, there must be a reason that they're there, and again, that's among the people that are aware of it. As you pointed out, there's many people that just really don't know what goes on and what's going on here. And going back to the Bush years, George W. Bush, in a rare joint press conference at the time with then Prime Minister Tony Blair of Great Britain, when asked by seemingly intrepid reporter about, well, how they knew how these were the most dangerous people, right? Because as you said, there's this just endless rhetoric about how these are the most dangerous people. These people are gonna get us. We have to lock them up, and they're so especially dangerous that they absolutely need to be put in Guantanamo. You know, never mind about what we did after World War II in Nuremberg and put the Nazis on trial. These people are in a special class all of their own, outside of any real judicial system or oversight. And Bush was asked, well, how do you know they're dangerous? And this is after he just got done saying that the most dangerous people in the world are at Guantanamo. And the answer to that question was, well, because they're at Guantanamo Bay. It's that circular kind of reasoning that comes from the top down and reverberates throughout our culture. Just to be more specific with our listeners again, we're talking to Pardis Cabrai at the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccrjustice.org. What laws is the government actually violating in these procedures, in these policies?
If we're talking about the issue of targeting, our legal position is that when you are in recognized war zone. So if we're talking about Afghanistan, a situation of war triggers a different set of rules. It triggers the laws of war. And within that context, factually and, you know, within that legal framework, there is greater leeway in terms of detaining people and even killing them. It doesn't mean that every detention is lawful or every killing is lawful, but the rules are different. And that's because the law recognizes that in situations of immediate fighting and the exigencies of wartime, ordinary constitutional provisions just don't apply the same way. They can't apply the same way. But what we're talking about is, for example, in the al-Awlaki case, a targeting that occurred in Yemen. And despite conflict in Yemen and a certain level of violence, certainly, there is a high bar to call something a war and an armed conflict. And the United States is not at war in Yemen. It is not at war with Yemen or within it. There may be a presence of Al-Qaeda, but again, there are legally defined criteria that need to be satisfied to call something an armed conflict and to trigger those different set of rules. So our position in the case and the position we continue to take is that outside of immediate battlefields and zones of active hostilities, the law that should apply is the Constitution and international human rights law. And under that framework, you can only kill someone, and what we were talking about in the Al-Awlaki case was a U.S. citizen, with respect to whom clearly the Constitution applies. And on that point, you know, the majority of people who are bearing the brunt of these policies are not actually U.S. citizens. They're non-foreign citizens. So the government could make arguments, and they would try to in court, about the fact that the Constitution does not apply maybe to non-citizens, but it is at least clear that vis-a-vis, you know, U.S. targeting and killing by the government, U.S. government against one of its own citizens, that due process and the Constitution applies. And according to that standard, you can only kill, the government can only kill someone if they've been afforded process, there's been a conviction for a capital crime, and there's been a sentence of death. Outside of that process, you can only kill in self-defense, and that means that there has to be an imminent threat, an immediate threat of deadly harm, and lethal force has to be a last resort. And what happened in the Al-Awlaki case was that this person, despite what the government was saying about him, was on a kill list of some kind maintained by the CIA and secret military forces that have reportedly, you know, these lists maintain names of people for months at a time. They're reviewed periodically, every few months, reportedly, and this is what credible news sources like the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post have reported. You know, just that very fact of keeping people on lists that are reviewed months at a time undermines this idea of immediacy. And what we know in the actual killing that took place against Al-Awlaki in September of last year, September 30th of 2011, was when the U.S. actually carried out the strike, is that they had been surveilling him for weeks, potentially, before he was actually killed. That also undermines this idea of an imminent, immediate threat. And that the killing was based on facts that have been reported in cooperation and in coordination with Yemeni officials, which undermines the idea that there couldn't have been other, you know, potentially other measures taken, non-lethal measures taken. I think what's important for people to remember is, even if you think and if you believe the government's story about who this person was and that he presented a threat, killing, again, really has to be a last resort. And when we don't accept that, and that's not a standard we're putting forward, that's a constitutional standard, when we don't accept that, it leads to a very slippery, scary slope of what is possible. And that's our concern looking forward is, you know, when there are reports of the CIA drone program expanding, what they're doing in Pakistan, expanding to places like Yemen, and hearing reports of potential U.S. involvement in strikes in the Philippines and definitely in Somalia, you know, who knows where else, there's a real concern about just the escalation and expansion of war and violence led by the United States in the name of national security.
Pardis, yeah, exactly. And I wanted to touch upon the expansion in Pakistan. I just read, you know, it seems like every time I'm reading about the drone strikes under Obama, it's just getting more expansive, more far-reaching. I was wondering if you could speak upon the signature strikes and kind of the indiscriminate group targeted assassinations that are happening in Pakistan.
Yeah, the signature strikes, I mean, I think part of the problem with this program is the secrecy and the lack of transparency. And just to be clear about some factual things, the strikes, the drone strikes and strikes carried out in other ways that we're talking about outside of situations of war, so outside of Afghanistan, for example, are mostly carried out by the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command, which is a secret unit of the military. In Afghanistan, when the military, regular military forces carry out these strikes, the rules by which they operate are known. There can be, and there often is after the fact of a killing, an investigation and some kind of accounting, and in some cases compensation even. What we're talking about in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and wherever else is a bizarre situation where we know that drone strikes are occurring, we see the deaths, we see drone pieces. We certainly have independent researchers documenting or trying their best to document what's happening, but we still have an administration that officially refuses to acknowledge that this program even exists, let alone disclose any meaningful information about the criteria they use or the rules that govern the procedures or where it operates, who's being killed, how many are being killed. So just going back to the signature strikes, there's very little known exactly about the criteria that are used or what the strikes, how the strikes are governed and what procedures are used. But my understanding of the signature strikes is that they're strikes carried out based on observing patterns of behavior and patterns of life, and they're not necessarily people who are on kill lists. They're just individuals who, based on unknown criteria, are deemed to be engaging in threatening behavior or conduct, and that are killed.
Well, you mentioned Pardis Cabrera. Excuse me. You mentioned that scary, slippery slope, and here we are, sliding further into it. And this was reported. This was in Wired magazine. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal. Even, I mean, again, these are pretty mainstreamed, even corporate media sources here. One article, CIA drones kill large groups without knowing who they are. This is a quote from the Wall Street Journal. Men believed to be militants associated with terrorist groups, but whose identities aren't always known.
Right.
So the CIA is killing people without even knowing who they are,
right,
on suspicion of association with terrorist groups. I mean, how many degrees away from certainty are we here?
Right. Many degrees. And, you know, just in terms of context, too, on these signature strikes, when you consider just family relationships and just the context in Pakistan, where sometimes you've got 30, 40 people in one home, family members living together or entire communities living under one roof. If you've got one individual the government has been tracking and deems to be a threat, when they're in that home and a missile strikes, everyone dies. And that is how we've got the numbers that have been reported, and according to sort of moderate estimates, for example, the New America Foundation, that is, I think, even by the administration, perceived to be sort of a nonpartisan, unbiased group that has been documenting these strikes, there have been hundreds of civilian deaths in Pakistan alone just over a period of years that where strikes have actually been documented. If you talk to the government, though, amazingly, the U.S. official who said there were zero civilian casualties in Pakistan for the year 2011. I mean, there's something wrong between how the United States is defining civilian or militant and how the rest of the world and people who are actually on the ground documenting this stuff are what they're seeing.
It's simply propaganda and deception.
I agree with you, but I think wherever you stand, I think there is growing consensus at least on the need for some transparency. And the government says, well, we've given transparency. Well, how can there be transparency when you still have an administration that still doesn't officially acknowledge that this program exists?
Right. It seems like whatever the government says, you know, this is an insurgent, and that must be true.
Right.
Anyone we kill with a drone is now just an insurgent without any sort of due process or evidence against him. I was wondering if you could expand upon now the congressional approval of the domestic use of drones in the United States and the surveillance that we're going to be seeing in a couple of years. What do you think about that?
Well, I know that the drone technology is another piece of this, and the legal issues with drones, to the extent there may not be legal issues, or the government is talking about how they're more precise and actually as a method of killing, they're not problematic legally, there are certainly ethical issues at least. These drone operators sit in rooms thousands of miles away, for example in Nevada, watching targets and people on video screens, and with the press of a button, make decisions to kill people, and then drive home to their families and pick up their kids from soccer practice and have dinner. There is something very scary and concerning about how the use of drones is further dehumanizing the act of killing and war. And I think that's something people should be thinking about, separate from the legal issues, just the ethical and moral issues with that, and how much easier it makes killing and warfare.
And just the chilling effect, you know, just curbing
Absolutely.
Political activism and dissent, knowing that there's these drones surveilling the country. So,
absolutely.
You know, it's really a privacy issue.
Yeah, and then there are billions of dollars being poured into research and drone technology and advancements for these for drones. And the way we're seeing them being used in the United States so far is, as far as what's been reported, they've been used and are being used for surveillance. along borders. There's talk of them being used by law enforcement, by police departments, for surveillance purposes. I mean, the capacity of drones is really limitless, and we know that there's a lot of money that's being poured into research and technology to further advance the technology. So what's possible and what may come in the United States is unknown. So far, they are being used for surveillance by law enforcement, for border control. I know that there are some groups in the United States that have filed Freedom of Information Act requests to get more information on exactly how these things are being used and the basis for authorizing them in the United States. But certainly they're present here. They're in the skies in the United States, and it's really a question and a concern about what may come here to the extent that people are not concerned about what the United States is doing abroad.
That's right. Pardis Cabrera, we're also talking about priorities, and when we hear these these cries of austerity coming from on high, they ring pretty hollow, one would seem, when so much is being sunk into these incredibly dubious and problematic type policies of targeted killing, of surveillance, not just abroad, but here at home, potentially. We have 1 minute left. Pardis, could you tell us what are you trying to accomplish then through the courts? Why is this important? Why should people get active in it? And where can they get more information?
Mm-hmm. What we were trying to do with the courts in our last case was just impose a process of review over these decisions. There's and to force some level of transparency. And we will continue those efforts in the courts and take them as far as we can. What I would say is with Guantanamo, the poll numbers are what they are in the United States, but there are still a lot of people, I think, who are outraged by Guantanamo because it was so known, and I think we still talk very much about the detentions there. I think what people need to do is educate themselves about this killing policy as well, and we need the same level of outcry and the same demand for transparency and information. People should know, at a minimum, what the United States government is doing in their name and with their money. I think that, you know, for more information, please go to our website, ccrjustice.org. We have information about the prior case we brought on behalf of Alawaki, and we'll be putting out more information. And I think at this point, just the basic minimum is educate yourselves about what the United States is doing in your name.
That's the voice of Pardis Cabrera from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and that's certainly what we're trying to do here at Free Speech Radio. We're trying to get the word out and get people to really understand what's going on and understand what's at stake. Pardis, thanks so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule and your important work. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.